The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 3, The Yoga of Divine Love, Chapter 5, page 577, The Divine Personality. One question rises immediately in a synthetic yoga, which must not only comprise but unify knowledge and devotion. The difficult and troubling question of the Divine Personality. All the trend of modern thought has been towards the belittling of personality. It has seen behind the complex facts of existence only a great impersonal force, an obscure becoming, and that too works itself out through impersonal forces and impersonal laws, while personality presents itself only as a subsequent, subordinate, partial, transient phenomenon upon the face of this impersonal movement. Granting even to this force a consciousness that seems to be impersonal, indeterminate, void in essence of all but abstract qualities or energies. For everything else is only a result, a minor phenomenon. Ancient Indian thought, starting from quite the other end of the scale, arrived on most of its lines at the same generalization. It conceived of an impersonal existence as the original and eternal truth. Personality is only an illusion, or at best, a phenomenon of the mind. On the other hand, the way of devotion is impossible if the personality of the divine cannot be taken as a real reality, and not a hypostasis of the illusion. There can be no love without a lover and beloved. If our personality is an illusion, and the personality to whom our adoration rises only a primary aspect of the illusion, and if we believe that, then love and adoration must at once be killed, or can only survive in the illogical passion of the heart denying, by its strong beats of life, the clear and dry truths of the reason. To love and adore a shadow of our minds, or a bright cosmic phenomenon which vanishes from the eye of truth, may be possible. But the way of salvation cannot be built upon a foundation of willful self-deception. The Bhakta indeed does not allow these doubts of the intellect to come in his way. He has the divinations of his heart, and these are to him sufficient. But the sadhaka of the integral yoga has to know the eternal and ultimate truth, and not to persist to the end in the delight of a shadow. If the impersonal is the sole enduring truth, then a firm synthesis is impossible. He can at most take the divine personality as a symbol, a powerful and effective fiction, but he will have in the end to overpass it, and to abandon devotion for the sole pursuit of the ultimate knowledge. He will have to empty being of all its symbols, values, contents, in order to arrive at the featureless reality. We have said, however, that personality and impersonality, as our minds understand them, are only aspects of the divine, and both are contained in his being. They are one thing which we see from two opposite sides, and into which we enter by two gates. We have to see this more clearly in order to rid ourselves of any doubts with which the intellect may seek to afflict us as we follow the impulse of devotion and the intuition of love, or to pursue us into the joy of the divine union. They fall away indeed from that joy. But if we are too heavily weighted with the philosophical mind, they may follow us almost up to its threshold. It is well, therefore, to discharge ourselves of them as early as may be by perceiving the limits of the intellect, the rational philosophic mind, in its peculiar way of approaching the truth, and the limits even of the spiritual experience, which sets out from the approach through the intellect, to see that it need not be the whole integrality of the highest and widest spiritual experience. Spiritual intuition is always a more luminous guide than the discriminating reason. And spiritual intuition addresses itself to us not only through the reason, but through the rest of our being as well, through the heart and the life also. The integral knowledge will then be that which takes account of all and unifies their diverse truths. The intellect itself will be more deeply satisfied if it does not confine itself to its own data, but accepts truth of the heart and the life also, and gives to them their absolute spiritual value. The nature of the philosophical intellect is to move among ideas and to give them a sort of abstract reality of their own, apart from all their concrete representations which affect our life and personal consciousness. Its bent is to reduce these representations to their barest and most general terms, and to subtilize even these, if possible, into some final abstraction. The pure intellectual direction travels away from life. In judging things, it tries to get back from their effects on our personality and to arrive at whatever general and impersonal truth may be behind them. It is inclined to treat that kind of truth as the only real truth of being, or at least as the one superior and permanent power of reality. Therefore, it is bound by its own nature to end in its extremes at an absolute impersonality and an absolute abstraction. This is where the ancient philosophies ended. They reduced everything to three abstractions: existence, consciousness, and bliss of being. And they tended to get rid of the two of these three, which seemed dependent on the first and most abstract, and to throw all back into a pure, featureless existence from which everything else had been discharged. All representations, all values, except the one infinite and timeless fact of being. But the intellect had still one farther possible step to take, and it took it in Buddhistic philosophy. It found that even this final fact of existence was only a representation. It abstracted that also and got to an infinite zero, which might be either a void or an eternal inexpressible. The heart and the life, as we know, have an exactly opposite law. They cannot live with abstractions. They can find their satisfaction only in things that are concrete or can be made seizable, whether physically, mentally, or spiritually. Their object is not something which they seek to discriminate and arrive at by intellectual abstraction. A living becoming of it, or a conscious possession and joy of their object, is what they seek. Nor is it the satisfaction of an abstract mind, or impersonal existence to which they respond, but the joy and the activity of a being, a conscious person in us, whether finite or infinite, to whom the delights and powers of his existence are a reality. Therefore, when the heart and life turn towards the highest and the infinite, they arrive not at an abstract existence or non-existence, a sat or else a nirvana, but at an existent, a sat purusha, not merely at a consciousness, but at a conscious being, a chaitanya purusha, not merely at a purely impersonal delight of the is, but at an infinite I am of bliss, an anandamaya purusha. Nor can they emerge and lose his consciousness and bliss in featureless existence, but must insist on all three in one. For delight of existence is their highest power, and without consciousness, delight cannot be possessed. That is the sense of the supreme figure of the intensest Indian religion of love, Sri Krishna, the all-blissful and all-beautiful. The intelligence can also follow this trend, but it ceases then to be the pure intellect. It calls in its power of imagination to its aid. It becomes the image-maker, the creator of symbols and values, a spiritual artist and poet. Therefore, the severest intellectual philosophy admits the saguna, the divine person, only as the supreme cosmic symbol. Go beyond it to reality, and you will arrive, it says, at last to the nirguna, the pure impersonal. The rival philosophy asserts the superiority of the saguna. That which is impersonal is, it will perhaps say, only the material, the stuff of his spiritual nature out of which he manifests the powers of his being, consciousness and bliss, all that expresses him. The impersonal is the apparent negative out of which he loses the temporal variations of his eternal positive of personality. There are evidently here two instincts, or if we hesitate to apply that word to the intellect, two innate powers of our being, which are dealing each in its own manner with the same reality. Both the ideas of the intellect, its discriminations, and the aspirations of the heart and life, their approximations, have behind them realities, at which they are the means of arriving. Both are justified by spiritual experience. Both arrive at the divine absolute of that which they are seeking. But still each tends, if too exclusively indulged, to be hampered by the limitations of its innate quality and its characteristic means. We see that in our earthly living, where the heart and life followed exclusively failed to lead to any luminous issue, while an exclusive intellectuality becomes either remote, abstract, and impotent, or a sterile critic, or dry mechanist. Their sufficient harmony and just reconciliation is one of the great problems of our psychology and our action. The reconciling power lies beyond in the intuition. But there is an intuition which serves the intellect and an intuition which serves the heart and the life. And if we follow either of these exclusively, we shall not get much farther than before. We shall only make more intimately real to us, but still separately, the things at which the other and less seeing powers are aiming. But the fact that it can lend itself impartially to all parts of our being, for even the body has its intuitions, shows that the intuition is not exclusive, but an integral truth finder. We have to question the intuition of our whole being, not only separately in each part of it, nor in a sum of their findings, but beyond all these lower instruments, beyond even their first spiritual correspondence, by rising into the native home of the intuition, which is the native home of the infinite and illimitable truth. Ritasya Svedam, where all existence discovers its unity. That is what the ancient Veda meant when it cried, "There is a firm truth hidden by truth, the eternal truth concealed by this other of which we have here these lower intuitions. There the 1,000 rays of light stand together. That is one." Ritana ritam apihitam dhruvam dasha shata saha tastus tad ekam. The spiritual intuition lays hold always upon the reality. It is the luminous harbinger of spiritual realization, or else its illuminative light. It sees that which the other powers of our being are laboring to explore. It gets at the firm truth of the abstract representations of the intellect and the phenomenal representations of the heart and life, a truth which is itself neither remotely abstract nor outwardly concrete, but something else, for which these are only two sides of its psychological manifestation to us. What the intuition of our integral being perceives, when its members no longer dispute among themselves, but are illumined from above, is that the whole of our being aims at the one reality. The impersonal is a truth. The personal, too, is a truth. They are the same truth seen from two sides of our psychological activity. Neither, by itself, gives the total account of the reality, and yet, by either, we can approach it. To be continued.